Bob Circus.
Good morning. Thank you for trading an hour of sleep for my voice. I'll describe some joint work with Mihir Bhalari and my grad student Viet Thung Hoang. And what I want to do today is to resurrect something from the long past and describe some foundations for garbled circuits. I suspect that most of you have seen garbled circuits before. I mean by this the same thing that's sometimes known as encrypted circuits or scrambled circuits. All of these terms seem to be used frequently. When I say that I'm going to provide foundations for these objects, it's actually not garbled circuits that I'll be defining. I'm going to focus on the garbling scheme, as it's called, which is the thing that outputs, perhaps, a garbled circuit. So we'll identify this notion of a garbling scheme as some object worthy of study, and I'll provide it with some underlying syntax, which I think shouldn't be minimized. One needs to somehow find a good syntax for these objects before you can hope to develop security notions that sit on top of that syntax. I'll describe a variety of security notions for garbled circuits. I don't think we're in a setting in which a single security notion actually covers all the set of applications that garbled circuits are used for. And we'll then look at efficient protocols for achieving these notions of security, particularly protocols instantiated from block ciphers, which I suspect are the preferred way of actually realizing garbled circuits these days. And we'll talk about proofs, what you can show about these schemes and the relations among notions. So when I imagine speaking about garbled circuits in an audience like this, I imagined kind of quizzical looks that pretty much anyone would assume that the foundations for garbled circuits were worked out a very long time ago. And I think it's natural to assume this to be the case. This is a very old area. It's usually dated to 1986, ancient history and cryptography, and not just an old area, but this is really a very extensively used idea. There's more than 1,300 references I found to papers that are apparently employing garbled circuits, and the breadth of applications of garbled circuits is pretty impressive. It didn't take long to collect these 30 applications that you can find papers talking about garbled circuit realizations for them. So nonetheless, I claim that a treatment of garbled circuits in the style that I'm going to do today is something that hasn't appeared before. And well, perhaps the history which I'll describe for garbled circuits will give some sense of why this might be true. But I think the main reason is that somehow garbled circuits have long been viewed as a tool and as a technique, and not somehow as a first-class object worthy of investigation. So I'm suggesting that they are, that we should look at this as a primitive proper. I don't mean to suggest that nobody has ever given a definition that somehow corresponds to that which garbled circuits do. In the 1,300 or so papers that use garbled circuits, I've been able to find about a dozen different definitions for what a garbling scheme or something like it might accomplish. These go back to Feige, Killian, and Noor in 1994. What most of these papers do is to, they have some particular protocol problem they want to solve, and rather than describe the solution in terms of a specific garbled circuit technique, they say Yao's construction provides the following properties, and we'll just use those properties. And that can certainly be turned around and taken as a definition. Most of the these definitions are intended for some specific application, and most of them will correspond to what we'll eventually call simulation-based privacy with respect to a particular site information function. So it would take the entire talk, I think, to try to compare what I do with these dozen or so definitions. I'm not going to do that. We'll instead jump in and look at the history of this area a little bit, and then describe the definitions. So as I think I mumbled a moment ago, garbled circuits go back to 1986. This is their official origins. This paper by Yaos on how to generate and exchange secrets, which talks about fairness issues in two-party computation. It's a nice short paper, 6 pages. But I'll tell you a secret. Maybe it's not a secret. I think everyone who works in this area, which hasn't actually included me for 20 years, but I think everyone who works in this area knows that that paper doesn't actually describe garbled circuits. I don't mean that they're described in some kind of convoluted way, that it's hard to see the garbled circuits in the paper. I mean they're really not there. No number of readings of the paper will reveal anything that looks like a garbled circuit. Some of the, nonetheless, in citations, one sees constantly that, we use the garbled circuit technique from Yao, 1986. And if you go back to the very earliest papers, you get, and if you talk to Silvio Macaulay or others, you see how this actually happened. The earliest papers often said, or not often, sometimes said something like, the above description of garbled circuits is based on oral presentations of Yao's work. So apparently, Yao gave talks, described a technique which has somehow been rendered as garbled circuits. But as we'll describe going through this, I'm not clear exactly what was the original technique. I think this is somehow lost to history at this point in time. I don't mean to suggest that Yao didn't invent this technique, however. I think the evidence is quite clear that he did. And there are certainly results in Yao's 1986 paper which could be proven using garbled circuits. Here's a theorem lifted from the paper. Nonetheless, it's always struck me as odd that this paper is credited for garbled circuits, not only this kind of peculiar convention of crediting a paper for something that everyone knows it doesn't actually contain, but beyond that, I think you would more expect garbled circuits to have originated in this paper several years earlier, which describes two-party secure function evaluation. The technique doesn't seem to have anything particularly to do with fairness, the topic of the second paper, whereas the usual description of what garbled circuits are used for is to solve this problem, that of the 82 paper. So let's see how it would be described in a more modern way as a solution for two-party secure function evaluation. So we're in the honest but curious setting. We have two parties, Alice and Bob, each with some private input, X and Y. If you want, you can think of these as n-bit strings. And they're going to engage in a protocol which is supposed to result in their jointly evaluating a function f. There's various variants of this. For simplicity, why don't I say that both Alice and Bob are supposed to learn the same value, f of x comma y. The function f is supposed to be understood by Alice and by Bob. And in particular, Alice and Bob are assumed to somehow have agreed to a circuit representing the function f, a Boolean circuit. In order to carry out the computation, one of the parties, let's say Bob, is going to construct this thing, we'll describe what it might look like in a bit, called a garbled circuit. The garbled circuit is somehow specific to Y. That's hardwired into it, you can imagine. And providing it to Alice, nonetheless, shouldn't reveal anything about Y. At the same time, Bob is going to produce a list of, we'll call them tokens, twice the number of tokens as there are inputs to the original function F. So for each input bit of F, we'll have a pair of tokens, a 0 superscripted token and a 1 superscripted token for the first bit, and so on. What does Bob do with this list of tokens? Well, he engages in a bunch of oblivious transfers with Alice. This is the version of oblivious transfer known as 1 out of 2 oblivious transfer. Alice is coming in with a single bit, xi. Bob's coming in with his 2 strings. Alice is supposed to learn the indicated string. Bob is supposed to learn nothing. In particular, he gets no idea which bit Alice possessed. At the end of this process, Alice now has half of these tokens, one from each pair. What does Alice do with this collection of tokens? Well, she evaluates the garbled circuit, capital F, on the vector of tokens. And by the miracle of modern alchemy, it equals precisely f of x comma y. Okay? Since we're in the honest but curious setting, we can assume Alice does what we ask her to, and she just provides that value then to Bob, who likewise outputs it. The first written account of garbled circuits is from GMW, from the paper on multi-party computation, where garbled circuits are used as a technique within this to achieve the author's goal. And let me describe how GMW portray garbled circuits, crediting Yao. For each gate of the circuit, we're going to create this garbled table. And for each wire of the circuit, we're going to associate a pair of public keys from some public key encryption scheme. So we generate a new public key, private key pair for each wire, two such pairs actually. And one of those public key, private key pairs will have a hidden semantics of zero, while the other one will have a hidden semantics of one. I've written the little zero to tell us that this one is supposed to have semantics zero. Possession of the decryption key for this guy is supposed to correspond to this wire having a hidden semantics of one. The tokens that will be given out to Alice in the prior slide, those are the corresponding decryption keys. If Alice were to know D1, the decryption corresponding to E1, and D3, then what could she do with that? She could decrypt all of the encryptions which are under E1 and all of the encryptions which are under E3. In this way, she would be able to decrypt, exactly one row of both tables. So there's two encryptions associated to each row of this table. For exactly one of the four rows, will both of them be known? What happens? Those two values are decrypted, and inside the two plain texts that are recovered, those are XORed together, and the table is constructed so that XOR is precisely the decryption key for the output wire with the correct outgoing semantics. Okay, that is the scheme. Bob could certainly set up these tables, generate all the needed public key, private key pairs, and let it fly. I think if you've seen a more modern account of garbled circuits, this one might look a little funny, actually. In a few ways. First of all, I've described this in terms of public key encryption. And a contemporary explanation of garbled circuits would actually be in the symmetric setting. There doesn't seem to be any reason we should be using public key cryptography in this context. Before that, garbled circuits were described in terms of factoring, apparently. All indications are that in Yao's lectures on this topic, the technique wasn't, in fact, based on an arbitrary public key encryption scheme, but based on factoring. Another oddity, I suppose, is that these two pieces are XORed to result in the outgoing key. There seem to be lots of other natural ways that present themselves in order to go from the pair of keys we possess to the correct outgoing key. Finally, it seems a little awkward to identify the correct row of this table to use. The intent would seem to be that we decrypt all of the table, and somehow only one of the rows of the table is going to make sense. In this public key setting, I guess that is guaranteed. When we recover a particular decryption key, we'll know if it corresponds to the associated encryption key. Nonetheless, this seems an awkward way of somehow identifying the correct row of each table. Here is a later version of garbled circuits, as described in a paper by Beaver, McCauley, and myself, and then in my own thesis. So we'll move now to the symmetric setting. Associated to each wire of the circuit will again be two tokens. Think of them as k-bit strings. But now these will again have some hidden semantics, as written in red, except for the output wires of the circuit, where I'll just establish the convention that the hidden semantics is the last bit of the token. Indeed, for all of the tokens, we'll arrange for each wire, one has a last bit of 0, the other has a last bit of 1. You can consider this the type of the token. So tokens are either type 0 or type 1. Each wire has one token of each type. The type is divorced from the semantics. Here the type 0 token has semantics of 0. Here the type 0 token has a hidden semantics of 1. Inside each row, we're going to put a value. Inside each garbled gate, we're going to put 4 values. And each of these values will be constructed as follows. We'll take a pseudo-random function, was actually described as a generator in the original paper, which has a very tiny input, just a single bit. That input will be the last bit of the token. So if we possess this token and this token, we will go to this row, knowing that 0, 0 is always to be associated with the first row, and we will recover S by recomputing F sub A, discarding that last bit, from 0, F sub C, our pseudo-random function, discarding the last bit of 0, XORing it with the contents of this first row, and that will be the value S, the correct outgoing token. Okay. Here is the example. We originally possess these 3 tokens. We'll go to this row. That'll inform us as to this outgoing wire's token. We'll feed that into this next gate, garbled gate. That'll inform us as to the final outgoing token. Its last bit is defined as the semantics for that gate. We've computed 1. There's a little problem with this protocol. It's actually wrong. This strikes me as a little bit ironic, because for years and years I would see people cite my own thesis with this buggy protocol as the best place to look for a fully worked out proof for what garbled circuits actually were providing you. But Tate and Hsu, in 2003, finally pointed out that there's a significant bug. Here I'll illustrate the bug. Let's again have these 3 tokens, but now I've arranged that the same token is feeding both of these gates. The fundamental problem here is that we haven't really separated what's going on in this gate from what's going on in this gate, and that's going to lead us into trouble. Knowing these 2 tokens, the party evaluating it can compute all of these values that I've highlighted. Similarly, the party evaluating this gate computes all of these values. We should propagate up and compute this value. But you should notice that this row of this table and this row of that table differ by exactly this value f sub d of 1. That means we can XOR the contents of these 2 rows and have f sub d, and from that everything falls apart. Those other values were supposed to have remained hidden. They haven't. In particular, we'll now easily discern, knowing f sub d, that these 2 values are the same s. This was an AND gate, so s must be the bit which has semantics 1. We've learned our internal values that we should not have learned, our internal semantics. So this is not right. Tate and Zhu's solution was to provide some sort of additional splitter gate, that we would have a 1 input, 2 output gate, and they liked that in this way we could retain most of the proof that I had written up in my own thesis. I think this was never much notice, probably because there was really a better formulation of how garbled circuits evaluation should look in a paper by Noor, Pincus, and Sumner in 1999. Here, all we do that differs from the last case is that the first entry of each table will now specify the identity of the gate that's being used. The problem from the last slide seems to vanish, and this looks like a good scheme. Noor, Pincus, and Sumner didn't provide a proof that this scheme works, and in fact, the trend somehow got established early on that people didn't really prove that these techniques were achieving any specified goal. in the protocols that use them. Rather, the protocol that used them was treated atomically as the goal. To the best of my knowledge, apart from my own thesis and then its correction by Tate and Zhu, the first real proof for garbled circuits appears in a Journal of Cryptology article by Lindell and Pincus quite recently in 2009. Older versions of that paper go back to 2004, and I'd like to sketch what exactly they prove, since it's become highly customary to just cite this article whenever you want to say that your garbled circuit construction is correct. The version of garbled circuits they're using uses composition instead of XOR, as in the prior two examples. I'm not exactly sure where composition became widely associated as the instantiation of garbled circuits. The earliest reference I can find that uses composition as the means of achieving garbled circuits is from a manuscript by Oded Goldreich in 2001. So, using Oded's version of garbled circuits, where this is composition now of symmetric key encryption schemes, which are assumed to achieve semantic security. So we're composing symmetric encryption schemes. We do not use the trick from the last couple of slides, which has now been called the point and permute trick of indicating which row of the table to employ. So instead, what's imagined is that one of the two tokens for each wire has hidden semantic 0 and the other one 1. We will trial decrypt each of the four rows of the table using the decryption key of A and the decryption key of C, for example, if that's the pair of tokens that we possess. And we expect somehow that only one of these four rows looks like a valid plain text when we decrypt it. The other three rows, they should somehow be recognizably garbage. In this manner, we'll be able to come up with the correct outgoing token, and we propagate those up. At the very end, again, there's a hidden semantics for output wires, and it's included as part of the garbled circuit. Okay, so this is the technique that Lindell and Pincus focus on in their proof. And you can see from the way I've described this that we're going to have to assume a little more than just that this was a conventional symmetric encryption scheme. In particular, we'll have to assume, in addition, that it has the properties that the authors call an elusive range and an efficiently verifiable range. Besides these two properties, which ensure correctness and that we can identify the right row to use in order to propagate the tokens up, besides these two properties, the authors assume, of course, a secure oblivious transfer, and then prove that the protocol so constructed is a two-party secure function evaluation in the honest but curious setting. Okay, and here I'm describing more formally the definitions for an elusive range and an efficiently verifiable one. I'd like to make a couple of points about this protocol. First, that it is specific to establishing two-party secure function evaluation. And what I showed, I think, on the third or fourth slide was the breadth of applications. I don't think you can just point to a proof for thing B and say that you've established the basis for achieving that when this is just used within that. The assumptions are non-standard, these two properties. But they're not hard to achieve. We can start with a conventional block cipher, for example, and we can build a semantically secure symmetric encryption scheme that has these two properties. We certainly can do that. And Lindell and Pincus give some hints as to what they have in mind for carrying out such a construction. It's not specified in full. When I go through it, get that depending on assumptions you make, maybe 24 to 40 block cipher calls are needed to compute each gate. Okay? A factor of 4 of that is just that we're not using that point and permute technique, but additional overhead is associated to having to build in these two characteristics. Now, Lindell and Pincus weren't trying to maximize efficiency here. They were trying to prove security in the version of Yao's technique which they viewed as truest to the original conception. Implementations have become important here, however. In recent years, going back to Fairplay in 2004, lots of people have implemented secure function evaluation in the two-party and in the multi-party setting, in the honest but curious case, and in more malicious adversarial settings. Many people have implemented this technique, and we've seen increasing efficiency in their solutions. There's been some very nice ideas to help improve efficiency in this setting. I'll mention a couple of them. An oblivious transfer extension trick, a very cute free XOR method that allows you to propagate tokens up an XOR gate by just XORing the tokens, so effectively tiny computation per gate when that gate is an XOR gate. This seems like it wouldn't be of much value, but in fact it is, because clever rewritings of your circuit will often result in 30% or more XOR gates without a big increase in the number of non-XOR gates. There's a nice row reduction trick. In particular, it's easy to kill one row of each of those three of each of the four rows of the truth table while still preserving the possibility of using this free XOR trick. And you can kill even a second row if you're willing to give up this property. The most recent work I've seen in this implementation direction is from Jonathan Katz and his students, and he's now demonstrated that you can compute very large circuits in excess of a billion gates at something around 10 microseconds per gate. Okay, so these techniques have actually progressed quite far, and I think at this point, garbled circuits should not be viewed as a theoretical technique as once they were, but really as something quite practical to implement and possibly superior in many cases to the dedicated solutions people have devised for solving particular SFE problems. Okay. So for given the number of implementations and the interest in this, I think it's a problem that the proofs are effectively in a different setting. None of these techniques use the Lindell-Pincus instantiation that I just sketched with a semantically secure encryption scheme. Instead, what the implementations typically do is to use a hash function and go to the random oracle model and assert that the techniques still work there, though usually without supporting proofs. Okay, so I think I've now sketched the history, and I think where we're at is that there's a very well understood garbled circuit technique that's now very widely used. A spattering of definitions that seem to get at what particular applications need, but really not a careful treatment of this subject and an investigation of definitions and instantiations in support of efficient realizations like those we've just talked about. So I'd like to define garbled circuits in a way that covers most applications. I cannot cover them all. I couldn't even read all of those papers, certainly. But and some of them we'll be using things about garbled circuits which go beyond what I know how to treat in a nice modular way. But I'd like most of the applications to be covered. I'd like the definition to be representation independent in the sense that it seems unnecessary to assume that what you're garbling is a Boolean circuit. And in fact, there are lots of things which have been garbled nowadays that are not Boolean circuits. One can find treatments, of course, of arithmetic circuits, and beyond that, stranger objects, garbling branching programs, circuits with lookup tables, OBDDs, ordered binary decision diagrams, DFAs, and so on. There's a lot of ways to represent the original function f, not a circuit, and a good definition of what garbling is supposed to do should encompass those. I want to support both concrete and asymptotic treatments. I think if we're heading towards effective realizations, it's important that we can handle both settings. In particular, we shouldn't confuse N, the number of parties participating in the computation, with K, the security parameter. We may well be interested in a very particular circuit to evaluate, so N is fixed, but K should still be able to grow independently of that. So from that enormous universe of applications, we've been guided by four of them in figuring out what breadth we should utilize for our definitions and our syntax. The first you've seen, two-party secure function evaluation in the semi-honest setting. The second well-known application is what's called private function evaluation. In the private function evaluation problem, one of the parties comes in with a function f. That function is supposed to be kept secret. The other party comes in with x, and that party is to learn f of x, but nothing about f. Okay, this problem, I believe, was first described by Abadi and Feigenbaum. Their solution was not based on garbled circuits, but that's where the problem comes from. Then we'll look at verifiable computation and one-time programs, and what demands they place on the garbled circuits that they use. So here is a high-level overview for the definitions. I'm going to start off by painting a common syntax to be using for this this broad set of definitions. And with that syntax in place, we'll look at a few different security goals. The goals are privacy, obliviousness, and authenticity. That's what I'll call them, and I'll describe in a few minutes what they are. Besides these three security goals, privacy, obliviousness, and authenticity, I'm going to look at both indistinguishability and simulation-based notions for the first two, for privacy and for obliviousness. If you take seriously this kind of analogy that we're encrypting a circuit, I think it's not surprising to think that there should be an indistinguishability and a simulation-based version, just as we have corresponding definitions for semantically secure encryption. Finally, we're going to look at how dynamic the adversary is. Our basic definitions will assume a static adversary. And when I say that we're assuming a static adversary, it's not going to mean that the tool isn't useful for those where, you know, dynamic corruptions are taking place. Nonetheless, the definition for our original goal will be in the static setting. That will suffice for the first two applications I mentioned, but then we'll look at increasingly dynamic adversaries. All right. So I guess this and the next slide are the main conceptual ones for describing the definition. We have some initial function f, and we want to garble it. So the function f, I'm going to assume, maps some domain of n-bit strings to some range of m-bit strings. It won't be important for most of what we do that the input and output are binary strings, but I think this will simplify matters. In order to proceed, we will garble f, conceptually turning it into a triple consisting of an encoding function e, the garbled function, capital F, and a decoding function, little d. What we want is that if you run the initial input x through the encoding function, you'll get a garbled input. Feed that garbled input into the garbled function, and you'll get a garbled output. Take the garbled output and decode it, and magically, you'll get the correct value y, the same value that you would have gotten had you gone through f. So the basic picture you should have in your head is that the function f is going to be partitioned into these three pieces, e, capital F, and d. In trying to make this rigorous and carry it out, we have a problem. It's not convenient to regard the input to an algorithm as some abstract function. We need a string to be fed into our function. It's very common to say, well, we just regard strings as functions, just assume some fixed encoding of strings as functions. But this viewpoint doesn't work for us, because we're quite interested in how functions are encoded. This is really the essence of what garbled computation is about. And so I need to make this I need to make this encoding of functions as strings quite explicit. So how will I do that? Instead of regarding E, F, D, and little f, instead of regarding them as functions, I'm going to regard them as strings. But each of those strings is to be interpreted as a function under the auspices of some corresponding algorithm. So we'll have a function little ev that evaluates the string f, and that is what we were a moment ago thinking of as the function f. Similarly, for these values, the encoding function is described by a string e, and en, with respect to e, that is the function that we, a moment ago, were thinking of as the encoding function itself. Here, then, is the formal syntax. A garbling scheme will be regarded as a five-tuple. It'll have a garbling algorithm, GB, an encoding algorithm, a decoding algorithm, an evaluation algorithm for the garbled function, and an evaluation algorithm for the original function. The first of these guys is probabilistic. You probabilistically turn your original function into that triple. And the next four, those can all be assumed to be deterministic. Here is how they glue together. You take your original function f, or the string describing that original function, really, and you feed it, along with a security parameter, if you're in the asymptotic setting, to the garbling function, which outputs a triple, the garbled function. Again, I mean the encoding of the garbled function, the encoding function, and the decoding function. The encoding function takes our, the encoding function as an actual function, takes the description of the encoding function and the original input x, and produces the garbled input capital X. The garbled function evaluation function takes the garbled function f and the garbled input capital X, and produces the garbled output, capital Y. The garbled output, capital Y, is fed to the decoding function, which, together with the description of how we're supposed to do the decoding, produces the final output, Y, and I'll also allow it to produce some distinguished bottom symbol, whose use will come up later. I think it's really quite natural, but has to be fixed, and that's what we've come up with. One more piece. We will need the evaluation function for the original function, little f. And we expect, of course, that if you go through the route on the top and you go through the route on the bottom, that you get the same thing. So there's the natural correctness condition that for whatever function f you choose and security parameter k and initial input x to that function, you get the same thing by evaluating or by directly evaluating the little function. Okay, so this is the syntactic picture you should have in your mind, and we'll use that same syntax for all of our security definitions. I'll put it up in the corner so that you don't forget it as we go through these definitions. I told you I was going to define three basic notions: privacy, obliviousness, and authenticity. With the syntax specified, I think it's easier for me to compactly describe what I mean by privacy, obliviousness, and authenticity. Privacy is saying, if you're given a garbled function and a garbled input and the decoding function, so as to interpret the garbled output that you're going to get in evaluating f at x, if you're given all of this, you should learn nothing except, what is this thing? You should learn nothing except that which you expect to be leaked about the function f and the value y, which is f of x. So I've introduced this new thing, the side information associated to little f. If we think to the two examples I've given, in the original two-party secure function evaluation, the original function f is assumed to be non-secret. So it's just fine to be leaking everything about f. In the second example we gave, a private function evaluation, the original function is supposed to be kept secret. That actually doesn't mean that you can hide everything about f. In that setting, the side information will be the number of gates, say, and the number of inputs and outputs of the function f. We expect that to be leaked, and we won't be able to achieve protocols that don't leak such information. Obliviousness. given the garbled function, capital F, and the garbled input, but not the decoding function. What do you learn? Nothing except that which is inherently leaked by knowing the garbled function. Authenticity, given the garbled function and its garbled input, you should only be able to compute as a valid Y the one you get by evaluating the garbled function at the garbled input. Certainly you can compute this one, F of X, but any other value that you would think to output, it should come out as invalid. That was the purpose of this allowance in the syntax. Here are some details I'd like to describe. First, I do expect that given the description of the garbled, the description of the initial function, you can compute its number of input bits and its number of output bits. It would be a very strange encoding such that there wasn't an efficient algorithm to compute those values from the string F. Second, I like to demand a kind of non-degeneracy condition. The idea in splitting up F into E, F, and D was that E is only supposed to be attending to the inputs. D is only supposed to be attending to processing the outputs. And all of the smarts associated to the processing of little f, it's supposed to be inside the garbled function. In order to capture this intuition and avoid at least some degeneracy, I'm going to say that little e and little d, the encoding function, should not depend on the details of little f. They're allowed to depend on the number of inputs and the number of outputs and the security parameter and even the length of F, but not on its specifics. Okay? If you don't make a requirement like this, then you admit kind of peculiar instantiations like that the encoding function is precisely F and these two guys do nothing. That's not really the intent of a garbled circuit computation. I want to make clear that I have not assumed the structure that we expect in the schemes like those that we described at the beginning of the talk today. I am not assuming that the encoding function consists of a list of two n tokens and that the encoding function extracts out the indicated tokens. This is how many schemes work, and in fact many applications will need your garbling scheme to have this property. But I think in a general treatment of the properties of a garbling scheme, it's undesirable to insist that your schemes have this characteristic. So I'll call a scheme projective if it does look like that. The encoding function specifies two n tokens. Given an n-bit string, the way you encode it is to select out the tokens indicated by that string. Okay. Not required, but the constructed schemes we give will certainly have this property. And many applications want it. So let's go back to this side information. So so I was indicating before that, well, just like encryption is expected to leak some information, its length or its existence, we expect that a garbled function likewise leaks some information about little f. As I mumbled before, in the two-party secure function evaluation setting, we permit the leakage of all of F. But saying that we permit it doesn't mean that the protocols actually do leak that much information. In protocols like those we saw earlier, we actually expect to be leaking less. What you somehow think that those protocols are leaking is the topology of F. When I say the topology of F here, I'm assuming that F is described by a circuit, and I'm saying that you've erased the functionality of each gate. Each gate has been replaced by a generic box. So you see the structure of the function, but not the function itself. That's actually a lot of information about the function, yet it is less than everything. Finally, in the private function evaluation setting, we expect to release the size of the description of F as a circuit. Okay? So here are three things we might expect to be leaking, and to formalize this and parameterize our definitions by it, we assume this side information function that maps strings to strings. And this string is supposed to encode that which you expect to be leaked of little f, right? This is applied to the original function, not the garbled function. For the three examples I've just described, the side information is n, m, and q, the number of gates, the number of inputs, the number of outputs. In the second case, it's the topology. I use this little symbol F superscript by a minus to mean that I'm just removing the indication of functionalities for each gate. And finally, the identity function. OK, let's give a definition. So here's our the way we'll define privacy. We're in the simplest setting, the static one. And I'm going to give first an indistinguishability-based notion. So my adversary, A, is going to query a garbling oracle with four things, a pair of functions, f0, f1, and a pair of inputs for those functions, x0, x1. I speak of it like a pair of functions, but of course I mean the strings. F0, F1, they're strings for us. What does the oracle do? Well, a bit is flipped, that bit ending up 1 or 0, equiprobably. If the bit is 1, we're going to really garble Okay, so if the bit is 1, we garble the left pair. We garble F0 and F1, kind of a funky convention, huh? We garble F0 and F1. If the bit is 0, we garble the right pair, F1 and X0. The adversary's job, of course, is to figure out which of those two things just got garbled. So it gets back what? The garbled function, the garbled input, and the decoding function. And based on that, it should output a prediction, B prime, whether its left or its right pair of functions and inputs were garbled. The adversary could trivially win this game by just choosing functions F0 and F1 that had different side information. After all, we're expecting the garbled function to be releasing the side information. So we impose this additional restriction that in the adversary's query of F0, F1, the two functions must have the same side information. Otherwise, the oracle can just be assumed to return bottom. Similarly, the adversary could trivially win this game by just asking an F0, X0, and F1, X1 that evaluated to different things. We've given the adversary the decoding function, so it can compute the garbled function at the garbled input, decode it to compute the actual value y. We need instead that F of X0 equals F1 of X1. We define the adversary's advantage in the natural way, the probability that the adversary correctly guesses the underlying bit, renormalized to the interval 0, 1. And if we're in the asymptotic setting, we would say that a garbling scheme is PRV secure in this indistinguishability sense if this advantage is negligible as a function of k for any polynomial time adversary. I actually like to write out my experiments these days as code-based games. So here is how it would look written as such. I think there's a lot of benefits to writing out definitions as short fragments of code. And I won't describe those benefits here, but I'll throw up a few such pieces of code as I go through these definitions. The code is specifying quite precisely our definition. Here's how the simulation-based notion would look. The adversary's queries are now simpler. It asks a single function f and an input x. And what does garble do? Well, again, an underlying random bit b is flipped, either 1 or 0 its outcome. If the outcome is 1, we really garble f and x. We compute the garbled function, the encoding and the decoding. We encode the input x according to the encoding function, and we return to the adversary the garbled function, its garbled input, and the decoding function. Alternatively, if the bit comes out as 0, we won't garble the function. Instead, we will ask a simulator to produce something that looks like fxd that would have come out from the garbling. What is the simulator provided in order to accomplish this purpose? Well, it gets f of x, the value y, and it gets the side information associated to f, and of course the security parameter. Based just on this information, we're hoping that the simulator can produce a triple that looks to the adversary as though it were a proper garbling with the proper garbled input. It outputs a bit b prime, which is its prediction of the underlying bit b, and the advantage is defined as you'd expect. And there it is as a game. How do these two notions of security relate to one another? Well, the simulation-based version implies the indistinguishability-based version. The indistinguishability-based version does not, in general, imply the simulation-based version. However, the indistinguishability-based version does imply the simulation-based version if we make some additional and modest assumption, which I will describe. So the two notions are not equivalent, but they're equivalent in the settings we care most about. My time is running low, so I'm not going to do any of the proofs. This was a sketch for that implication, and this is a sketch for this non-implication. The non-implication can work by just saying what happens if you try to garble a collision-resistant hash function. For example, the indistinguishability-based adversary isn't going to be able to come up with that original F0, F1, X0, X1 pair, so the adversary is going to get zero advantage, even though what it really meant was that it couldn't play the game. Yeah?
Simulation setting, how do you know that there are enough things which look like correct garblings?
Well, if there aren't, then the advantage won't be good.
Right. Yeah. But that doesn't impose any constraints on...
Not a priori, yeah. Okay. And then I was saying that you do get an implication under an additional assumption. Let me describe what that additional assumption is. We demand the existence of a polynomial time inversion algorithm that given what? Given an f of x value, s, and I'm sorry, an f of x value, y, and given some side information, s, manages to find some pre-image that corresponds to that pair. So you can somehow invert the side information that you're given and the final output y. Looking at the three kind of canonical side information functions, this one is easily seen to be efficiently invertible. So is this one, but that third one, where you leak the circuit, it is not efficiently invertible. So not every instantiation will meet this, not every side information function will meet this definition. Okay, and I'm going to again omit the proof. So at this point we've developed a notion of privacy, and this notion suffices for lots of applications. Here is a sampling of 10 of them where it seems to be enough. We haven't reproven the results of all of these papers using this definition, but I believe all of them can be recast to use these definitions, either over the side informations we called size or over circuit. Of course, if you're over circuit, then this notion should be the simulation-based one. If you're over size, then from what I've told you, it doesn't matter. The two notions are equivalent. I'm not doing well on time. What I've described is not enough to handle all of the applications that we're interested in. In particular, there's this lovely application of verifiable computing, which we've looked at. And the privacy that we've, and Gennaro Gentry and Parno make this lovely observation that we can use garbled circuits as a kind of one-time verifiable computing instantiation. In particular, this party here, the worker, is going to collaborate with this party, the client, to evaluate some function little f. The client will produce a garbled version of little f and send it to the worker. Possibly at some later point in time, an input little x will be the client will come up with and will provide a garbled input capital X to it. The worker will evaluate the garbled function at the garbled input, getting a garbled output y. The worker is not given the decoding function. That value is handed back to the client, and what Gennaro, Gentry, and Parno point out is that not only have we off-put the computation and preserved the privacy of x, but also in many natural constructions, it seems that we've obtained a kind of authenticity property, that when a focus value of y is returned, this can be detected over here by the client. This is nothing like what we've defined in our privacy-based descriptions. It doesn't capture, this is a different kind of confidentiality guarantee, and we call this obliviousness. We call the second property that I described authenticity. Our definitions can be slightly tweaked to capture obliviousness and then a different definition for authenticity. Here, this looks like our privacy definition, except we no longer return, you can see the ghost of it here, we no longer return the decoding function little d. In addition, the adversary is no longer compelled to ask a pair of messages, f0, f1, x0, x1, that agree when the first is evaluated at that point and the second is evaluated at this point. After all, the worker in that prior example isn't learning the value f of x0 and f of x1, so these two should remain indistinguishable as long as the side information associated to the function is the same. And here is a simulation-based version, which is similarly constructed by modifying the privacy definition from before. How do these two notions relate to one another? It's a similar picture. The simulation-based notion implies the indistinguishability-based notion of obliviousness. The converse is not in general true, but it is true under a weaker side condition. Here, simply that you're given the side information, you should be able to compute some function that has that side information. In order to come up with an example that doesn't have this property, you'd have to create something highly unnatural. So for any reasonable side information function, you will have the equivalence of simulation-based and indistinguishability-based obliviousness. And here's how we define authenticity. The adversary is given a proper garbling oracle, and its job in life is to come up with some value y, which will decode to something other than that distinguished bottom symbol, and the value y should be something other than the correct evaluation of f at x. Comparing now this complete set of definitions, everything that I've spoken about that you would think is not implied by the other notion is not implied by the other notion. Okay. Even in combination, for example, even assuming that a scheme is simulation-based private and oblivious, this conjunct won't imply authenticity, for example. So all these notions are distinct. I haven't spoken about how to achieve these ends. In my remaining 20 slides, we will describe such matters. So you can achieve these ends. And we look closely at the kinds of assumptions you need in order to achieve these ends. And what we're heading towards is trying to achieve nice schemes based on block ciphers. Our basic instantiation introduces a primitive we call a dual key cipher. While this may look like the same two-keyed objects from other treatments, these are now ciphers, not encryption schemes. Okay, not semantically secure, but a generalization of a block cipher. So we describe a scheme called Garble1 in terms of this primitive, and then we want to know, there's a very precise description of it, written out again as code, and I'm going to skip all of this. And then we instantiate that dual key cipher in a variety of ways. So the basic provable security results look like the NPS 99 instantiation. So we achieve a privacy achieving scheme using this instantiation from a pseudo-random function. And the results are made precise and quantitative. So this tells us how much security we lose in doing the garbling as a function of the resources for the underlying pseudo-random function. We're not done though, right? We have a pseudo-random function and it actually has an inconvenient domain and range. It's turning a k-bit key into a k plus one bit output. And this is necessary for that extra bit, that tight bit that has been plaguing us and that is not easily dealt with. Because if you just lump it into the key, for example, then you will not obtain provable security based on standard assumptions about the underlying pseudo-random function. What's going on here is that, you know, if you take a pseudo-random function and you fix one of its keys as zero, or one of its keys as one, this does not provably give you a pseudo-random function. You might think that at least one of those two objects should be a pseudo-random function, but it's not true. So we have to work around this kind of mismatch of keys and output lengths, and a variety of instantiations can do that. The simplest provably secure instantiation based from a block cipher would use two block cipher invocations, so four altogether for evaluating a gate. This is already much more efficient than the instantiation I described by Lindell and Pincus. We can certainly do better at an assumptional cost. So we could just assume that this object, keyed by 127 bits, let's say, the last bit fixed is zero if we're using AES, we could just assume this is a good pseudo-random function. That certainly seems like a quite reasonable assumption to make. And then we'd be down to two AES operations per call. And we can do much better. So it's possible to instantiate this in a more clever way within the random permutation model, or the ideal cipher model, so that we make use of just one AES call per garbled gate evaluation, and that and all of those AES calls using the same underlying key. The advantage of doing this is that modern hardware, since at least Sandy Bridge, has very efficient AES support, much more efficient than implementing a hash-based solution. I told you that the state-of-the-art implementation of multi-party computation was spending something on the order of 10 microseconds per gate. So that sounds good. If you translate this into clock cycles, this is what, like 20,000 clock cycles. And here, we probably have more than adequate parallelism to be supporting something around one gate per clock cycle. So I suspect that orders of magnitude improvement in garbled circuit evaluation remain possible. If I had additional time, I would tell you all about how we achieve dynamic security, and additionally how we can look at garbled circuits as a formal object in the kind of lockbox model that people routinely speak of them. But my time is gone, so I will end it there.
Time for a couple of quick questions.
Maybe the question would be, what about this lockbox?
I had a feeling I was a little over. So, you know, when people describe garbled circuits, they routinely use a kind of physical analogy that you have two keys, and usually it's just assumed to be a descriptive matter to communicate the idea. But there's no reason you can't push that kind of descriptive matter into a formal definition. So we've been undertaking that in ongoing work. And the way I like to do it is to take our code-based definition and to just add in extra routines. Continue. Correspond to creating a formal key. So you call some object and it says a key has been created. For opening a formal key, which just marks it as available. It's not as though some actual key is returned. For encrypting, which just sets a table entry in the code. And for decrypting, which just reads off an already set entry. So we can make a formal model that just puts all this functionality in the code and investigate how it relates to the computational model we've just given. So this is underway, and I don't really have time to sketch it.
I guess my other question, can I ask another question? I saw as you were going through, you had something about one-time programs, so...
So when we describe the dynamic security, we do it in two steps. One is this garbled input could depend on the garbled function, but the garbled input is still atomic. The second is that the garbled input is now assumed to, well, we assume we're in what I was calling the projective scheme, that you can ask an input bit xi and get the corresponding token. We generically turn a garbled circuit from, we generically turn a protocol achieving any of our three goals into a protocol achieving first the weak form and then the strong form of dynamic security. The one-time programs paper of yours and co-authors, I think all of whom are here, corresponds quite precisely to that second, stronger version of dynamic security. We're not able to prove that the construction that you give in that paper generically works. Instead, we give a much less efficient sequence of constructions to do the conversion.
Yes, thanks, speaker again.